Welcome into the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf. And normally, this is where we would tell you about John Rahm's equipment he used to win the U.S. Open. But why not instead hear from the champion himself?
For all those people that might have doubted the manufacturer change, you know, there was a reason why I believed I could get better. And the new ball and the new irons allowed me to hit certain shots that I simply wasn't capable of before. And it showed, you know, some of those wet shots and some of those long shots at 8-iron and one. I mean, being able to hit that shot high with spin, but still go through the wind and hit it short of the pin, and many others like that is what allowed me to stay as aggressive. So I need to say a huge thank to that, to the team in Callaway. You know, I gave them a headache. I don't know how many putters they've built for me to find the one I needed. And, you know, I'm pretty sure I found the one I need. This one's working really well. So, Joe, thank you for all the hard work. And we got one, boys. So I guess second one of the year.
Now, to learn more about Rahm's gear, visit callawaygolf.com/Rahm. All right, Rex Hoggart, we have successfully returned from Torrey Pines. I'm in my new crib in Ponte Vedra. I'm sure we'll be getting that. You're in like Dover, Delaware. Where are you? Are you playing blackjack right now?
I'm at Dover Downs, which is a casino. Yes, it's exactly what you would have thought. No, I'm actually with one of my children. We weren't able to do this normally. I guess apologies straight out of the gate. Normally we try to knock these out on Sunday night because we're fresh and we're excited about the tournament. We want to talk. We couldn't do that on Sunday night because you were on the red eye home from San Diego on Sunday. And then I was on the red eye the next night. So this is the earliest opportunity we've had an opportunity to do this. However, because I was on the red eye Monday, got home Tuesday morning, I was in my house for a grand total of 120 minutes before I got back on a flight. Flew to Dover for a lacrosse tournament, which I was at today, which I will say I'm tired and it's probably not, I'm probably not as happy as I probably could be. They know how to run a lacrosse tournament. There was a craft beer trailer at this place.
What kind of beer did they have?
I didn't see anything other than the IPAs. I think you know my weakness.
Sir, I'll have a double. Actually, make that a triple. So you were pounding double IPAs at 9 a.m. during a lacrosse tournament?
No, I waited for the last game. It was 11 o'clock. I felt like that was appropriate. It was the last game. I didn't want to be the obnoxious dad. So I got one and kind of hit off to the side. I didn't want to be around other people. I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. I'll admit.
You're right. We do like to knock these out on Sunday night. And I have to admit, after doing the red eye and sleeping a grand total of 0 minutes on said red eye, I don't think I'm going to sign up for one again. I'm 34. I think, what are you, 53, 54?
53. Yes. Keep going.
Yes. 53. These red eyes are not getting any easier. I mean, I used to be able to knock off for at least an hour, probably two, you know, I'll watch a movie, but like, these are getting really hard to do. And I was standing in the Atlanta airport trying to make my connection for Jacksonville. And I was so jittery and so thrown out of sorts. I had to actually sit down while I was waiting for my group to be called. So I was like, I need sleep. I need rest. I was so cranky all of Monday. I took like a 3-hour nap. I was all out of sorts. How are you doing?
There's nothing better than a golf writer complaining about taking the red eye home. Let's just continue down this train because that sounds to me like it's the best podcast ever.
Coming from the guy who was in Delta One, fully spread out, knocked back after a couple IPAs.
I was. Yes, I was. No, it was very good. I'll admit it was very good. But the better thing was, and we're going to talk about the US Open. Apologies right now, but we are distracted. I hung around an extra day because I had my son with me, my middle son, and he went to the Open for a couple of days.
Not the lacrosse son, different son.
No, different son. You got to meet him. So we hung around. We played Coronado Golf Club on Monday morning, which is unbelievably good, by the way. I mean, it was so much fun to play because the options were, they were very, very kind at the USGA, and they offered a tee time in the South Course, and everyone I spoke to said, no, you don't want to do that. Why don't you just go have fun and play Coronado? And I will totally agree. If you want to go have fun and enjoy yourself and enjoy scenic views of the bay, Coronado is a better option. If you want to go get punched in the face and thrown down a cliff, then let's go with Torrey Pines.
It's actually funny. So for media parking, we were parked on the Torrey Pines North Course, which I would have played 9 times out of 10 over the South Course. And that was our parking lot. And I was sitting there over there. I mean, there's big vans there. There was probably, you know, a couple thousand cars across the property. I said, this golf course still looks better. It still looks more fun to play, even with all this commotion than the South Course was. I saw your Monday follow, Rex, where you were basically pleading with the USGA to bring another US Open to Torrey Pines, even though all the architecture wonks and the geeks and the nerds and the dweebs in the golf world hate this little bit of architecture, especially after the Reese Jones renovation, basically 2 decades now ago at this point. Why would you want to bring another US Open to a golf course that basically by any metric or by any reasonable person's estimation is not necessarily a good golf course?
Well, I explain it and I made my argument. And here's the part that hurts the most, though. I'm going to say, as you were stomping out of the media center late on Sunday night to catch your red eye that you didn't sleep on.
I wasn't stomping. I was sprinting.
You were sprinting. I told you what I was thinking about doing on Monday morning. You rolled your eyes, said good luck with that, enjoy being ratioed. And I think you just started marching in the other direction. Like, that's the last I heard of you. Just a cloud of smoke and negativity on your way out of the tent.
Yes. I mean, you have been ratioed several times over the past week. And saying that Torrey Pines is a U.S. Open worthy golf course, one of our colleagues, Alan Shipnuck, expressed a similar opinion. He dropped a MFN in his copy, which not only would have gotten me thrown out of the media center and fired, but probably would have gotten me thrown in jail.
I did not do that in my column.
Why? What is your rationale for bringing back a U.S. Open to Torrey Pines? First of all, before we get to John Rahm.
And to a certain degree, I agree with the wonks. I don't pretend to be an architecture geek. I think I just pay attention in as much as, like I said, I play golf for fun. And that golf course doesn't look like fun. And I shed a tear just like you every day when we pulled into the parking lot and we were on the ninth green, on the ninth fairway on the north course, because I was like, this would be so much more enjoyable to play than what they're doing over there. And it's kind of monotonous. It's back and forth. It's a lot of 500 plus yard par fours straight away. There's nothing tricky to it. And yes, it could be better. My argument, though, is twofold, really. One, if we're going to do this rotation, which I think by all indications last week, the USGA sort of copped to the idea that we would like to do a rotation with the US Open, I think you have to have a Torrey Pines, just like I think you have to have a Bethpage, simply because if we're going to talk about golf being inclusive, I don't know how we have a rotation of, let's say, 10 golf courses that are all either ultra-private or very, very expensive resort courses. That's the first thing. The second thing is
Torrey Pines is expensive. It's like $300 to play.
Well, but by comparison, how expensive do you think Pebble Beach is or Pinehurst?
I mean, Pebble's $500 or $600.
And you have to stay at the resort, you have to stay at the lodge, so tack that.
Yeah, I mean, Pinehurst is probably similar.
It's expensive by the standards that you and I are going to go out and play Metro West in Orlando. Yes, it's expensive. However, I think when you look at what the USGA tries to do and make golf more inclusive, this is one of those cornerstones, I would argue. The second half of my argument is it's a West Coast venue. You love that primetime finish in the East. And then you look at what the last two Opens that have been played at Torrey Pines, how they played out. You have Tiger Woods on a broken leg going to Monday, beating Rocco Media at 19 holes on Monday. And then you have John Rahm really in what was an exciting shootout that you and I both wrote about because we felt so compelled that there was so much going on that I don't think we're going to write about the same thing. So you have two walk-offs. You have, let's admit, two winners. I think we can both agree to that. So I think all of those points lead to, yes, it's not architecturally the most romantic of venues. I will give you that. But it has done nothing to prove that it should not be a U.S. Open venue. There's not a player that said that it was either tricked up, it shouldn't be a U.S. Open venue. You and I both talked to a lot of guys last week, and none of them complained about that venue.
So you essentially use the Chambers Bay defense. And the Chambers Bay defense is look at the two tournaments that have been held on this golf course. That was the 2010 U.S. Amateur, which I covered, as well as the 2015 U.S. Open, which I also covered. In the 2010 U.S. Amateur, you had the number one ranked amateur in the world, Peter Uihlein, beat David Chung, who at the time was the hottest player in the world. That was Chambers Bay's debut on the world stage. The 2015 U.S. Open, you had a crazy golf tournament. And what did you have down? At the ending stretch, you had Jordan Spieth, number one in the world, who beat Dustin Johnson by a single shot after DJ three putted the 72nd hole. And so by that defense, you would want to have another U.S. Open at Chambers Bay now, wouldn't you? Because in those two tournaments, they were terrific. Do you think you'd have a different opinion? Let's say if Tiger had lipped out, not lipped in that putt on the 72nd hole in 2008, do you think we'd have a different story if John Rahm had missed those birdie putts on the 71st and 72nd holes and ended up losing to Louis Oosthuizen by one. So instead you have Rocco Mediate and Louis Oosthuizen winning those U.S. Opens and not Tiger Woods and Jon Rahm. You think you'd feel differently that way?
I mean, perhaps. It's unfortunate that this isn't a visual medium because you could have seen my face twist into a knot as you were trying to compare.
Oh, I saw it. I thought that was your bitter beer face.
No, it was twisting into a knot because you were comparing the 2008 U.S. Open, which I think we can all agree is by far the standard when it comes to major championships as far as drama and entertainment, to a U.S. amateur that, until you mentioned it, I couldn't have told you who won that. So I think your comparison...
That's just because you don't pay attention.
We'll put it on the poll. Let's actually ask people exactly, who do you remember? Do you remember who won the 2008 U.S. Open? Or do you remember who won the U.S. Amateur at Chambers Bay? I'm pretty sure which one that one's going to win.
Why can't you just remember both? It wasn't that long. It was 11 years ago.
It's a bad comparison. You're comparing apples to grapes. Like that's just not a very good comparison. The other half of it is you're glossing over. Yes, there is a part of my argument that you could make for Wingfoot. There's a part of my argument that you could make for a lot of U.S. Open venues. In the context that I gave you that, okay, with Bethpage and Torrey Pines, two truly public venues on both sides of the country, which are very advantageous. It's something the USGA wants. I think if you factor in that and you factor in the idea that the players like it, we can sit here and say it's boring to watch.
Do they like it?
Did you hear something negative? Did you hear something I didn't?
I didn't hear anything positive. What I heard a positive was about the setup, was about the USGA setup. I don't think anyone necessarily likes this golf course. I think it's a fine golf course. I think it's a decent golf course, but I don't think anyone's like, oh man, I love playing that South course at Torrey Pines. That's a great test to golf.
I'll go back to the field every year at Farmers Insurance, which is very, very good. So your point's kind of invalid on that front as well. If they really did not like it, they would not play the Farmers Insurance. There's plenty of other options. They could skip that one quite easily.
Well, actually, the field has gotten worse in recent years since more players are going to play on the European Tour's Desert Swing. But you're kind of glossing over that fact. If we look at the USGA rotation and the rotation that they're considering, according to your sources, for this U.S. Open rota, you have to put, let's see, Oakmont, Pebble, Wingfoot, Pinehurst, Shinnecock. So there's five. Did I say Bethpage?
You did not.
Okay, so there's six. I would agree that, I mean, that is an incredibly strong U.S. Open rota of six golf courses that I think everyone can get behind, right?
Sure, yeah. Those are
major markets, classic golf courses, terrific tests of golf that the USGA can set up into a U.S. Open test. I wouldn't have any problem with that. Now, I think there is room to add, you could call it like a wild card for the seventh. Whether one of those years it could be, you know, maybe you return to Chambers Bay and give it another try. I don't necessarily want to go back to Erin Hills because I thought that was kind of a bust.
Chambers Bay was a bust as well. I mean, look, the greens
were bad. They screwed up the greens. It's a great golf course.
There's an entire hole that can't even have spectators on it. Number eight, it can't. No one can see number eight because it's built into the side of a hill. That's not a good U.S. Open golf hole.
You can see it. You just got to look up. I don't think Whistling Straits is necessarily a good golf course for a major championship either, but they have one there.
Well, again,
let's not dive into your hatred for Chambers Bay anymore. What about Riviera one year?
Or LA North. I think LA North is going to be a very, very good venue. So I think that's
going
to
We're going there in a couple of years. I think that's a good test run there. So look, I think you have six really solid, indisputable U.S. Open golf courses for that rota. And then if they return to Torrey in the next 10 to 15 years, I wouldn't hate it. I don't necessarily need to, I don't need to see it again, but if they want to go back, I wouldn't be popping off on Twitter like a lot of these folks seem to do.
Honest, I did not get ratioed on this, which in my mind is actually worse because it's kind of like the wonks didn't care what I had to say. So
Did you tweet it out?
I actually didn't because, as I explained, I was.
How are you supposed to get ratioed?
I was in the air. I didn't want to tweet it out. I didn't want to deal with it. I knew that you were going to jump in. You were going to be one of the guys yelling at me. I just didn't want to.
You're a little gun shy after your COVID column.
I am.
I think that's the case. And actually, that's a good transition to the COVID boy, which is John Rahm, who, of course, was leading by 6 shots through 54 holes at the Memorial Golf Tournament that you were covering, got sent packing because of a positive test following some contact tracing. 2 weeks later, with very little prep, he wins the U.S. Open in impressive fashion, the aforementioned birdies on the 71st and 72nd holes. There's a lot to get to. There's a lot of layers to John Rahm, and we're certainly going to dive into them here. What was kind of your main takeaway in the focus of your game story that you wrote for golfchannel.com on Sunday night?
One of the cool things in his caddy, Adam Hayes, did you have a chance to talk to him on Sunday night?
Terrific caddy.
Yeah, it's very good caddy. One of the things that he said in context to the COVID and what happened at the Memorial is he actually put a bright spin on it. The way he explained it to me was earlier in the week at Torrey Pines, he told John, like, look, it's really hard to win back-to-back. Maybe it's for the best that we weren't there. And I know that's making lemonade out of lemons, but in this particular case, I think there was something there. And he was playing well. I mean, regardless of how that worked out and where you fall on either side of this, I'm not going to get ratioed again. But he was playing well. There was no reason for him to think, well, this is going to throw my game off, especially coming to a golf course. There is going to be a connection now between John Rahm and Torrey Pines that's essentially going to define his career. And I think that's really, really cool. He won his first PGA Tour start there in 2017 at the Farmers Insurance. He has won his first major there. He proposed to his wife along those same cliffs. He won on Father's Day for the first time as a father. There is such a connection that I think coming down the stretch, and I think you and I glanced at each other early Sunday morning, and it was something along the lines of, who do you like? And I said, well, I think my heart says Rory, but my head says Rahm, because everything pointed to John Rahm. And the fact that he was able to do it amid all that craziness, when I think we can both agree that he has a history of running hot on the golf course, of letting his emotions get the best of him. And when his emotions should have been at their most frazzled, when everything was going nuts on the golf course, he was at the best. He was the calm in the storm. I think it was an amazing finish by him.
It absolutely was. And in all respect to John Rahm, who I believe has established himself now as the most feared closer in golf. Not necessarily, let's say he's up by 3 or 4 shots that he's going to slam the door on you and embarrass you. But if you have John Rahm 2 or 3 shots behind, you have to seriously think that you're basically playing him straight up, that you need to approach the final round that way. He has developed such a reputation now for hunting down the front runner and just soaring past them, which is once again what we saw on Sunday at the U.S. Open. During a final round, Rex, that it's amazing to even think about this. There were 10 players at one point within 1 shot of the lead. And this wasn't just your run-of-the-mill PGA Tour player, like your boy Peter, what'd you call him? Peter Malanti? No, I mean,
Malnati.
This was...
His name is Peter Malnati, by the way. He played well. He qualified. He's pretty proud. He was in the U.S. Open.
Yep, you finally got his name right. Good for you. This was the best of the best, Rex. I mean, this was Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, Rory McIlroy, Colin Morikawa, John Rahm. I mean, it was everything you'd wanted in a major championship, and it was John Rahm who seemed to be the only person who seized it. You had Bryson, who came home in 44. You had Colin Morikawa, who made a couple of boneheaded mistakes. You had Rory McIlroy, who missed a couple of 5-footers. You had Brooks Koepka, who, for all intents and purposes, looked like he was going to be the one to post 5-under and probably sneak away with another title. He was the one who made a couple of bogeys late. And so John Rahm, as you eloquently put it, was the calmest among that tempest. And the lead to my column on Sunday night was, what would trigger another Rombo explosion this time? Because this is a player who has a history of running hot on the golf course. And for whatever reason, I think a lot of the credit has to go to Adam Kay's, John Rahm's caddy. I think a lot of credit has to go to this perspective season that John Rahm and so many others appear to be very much in the midst of, with having a newborn child. And John, look, I think this does get overplayed on the telecast. I do want to say that, you know, how he does have a new perspective on life and how he's viewing things differently. I mean, John himself said that he was embarrassed by the way that he conducted himself on Saturday of the PGA Championship about a month ago. We don't have the gory details, and quite frankly, we weren't really paying attention because Phil Mickelson was threatening to run away with a major championship at 50 years old. So really no one was paying attention. The only hint that we got was that when Jon Rahm was dragged into the media tent on Saturday night of the PGA Championship by a poor PGA media official, John basically was throwing up his arms and saying, "Why am I even here? Like, I don't want to be here right now." And so that was kind of a glimpse into what his mindset was that day. But that night, Jon Rahm and Adam Hayes had a heart-to-heart where Rahm said that he doesn't want to behave like that for his kid. He wanted to set a proper example. And so, sure enough, I thought with the way that he handled the memorial, which you wrote about it earlier in US Open week, was just nothing but graceful and poised and showed a lot of maturity for someone who's 26, 27 years old. And then the way that he conducted himself when all hell was breaking loose around him on Sunday at Torrey Pines, to me, just showed a lot of increased maturity and a maturity that we really hadn't seen to that point in what is still a very young career, now just 5 years and counting.
Well, it's amazing. And you brought up a really good stat. I think we both had it in our stories that at one point early in the back nine, 10 players either leading, co-leading, or within one shot of the lead. Within 45 minutes, that number was down to two. And one of those two was Jon Rahm. And it's amazing to think that, look, the putt on 17 was fantastic. 25 footer charged in. He understood what it meant. He understood where it put him on the leaderboard. And we're going to replay the putt on 18 because that's the one that won it for him. That's the walk off. And that's the cool one.
The bunker shot to me was just as impressive.
That's, and this goes to his maturity. We're in a lot of situations. It's hard to talk a player who runs that hot sometimes. And look, John is very, very good because he runs hot on the golf course. He plays on those emotions. He's not the first player to do that. He's not going to be the last. And this situation, though, there was no discussion between Adam and John about, hey, bud, maybe we need to steer a little bit right of this, not bring the water into play. They were both in agreement. Let's take our chances with an 18-footer. As far as execution goes, it does not get any better than that. I mean, I can go back to 2008 and compare it to the Tiger putt, but, and this is a recency bias, I completely understand, but as far as just pure execution of what you want to do and staying in the moment and not getting ahead of yourself, all of the cliches, John did it better than anyone else. And that showed a level of maturity that goes beyond being a 26-year-old father of one and whatever else we could say about him. It shows a level of maturity for a competitor that I don't think many people in the game have either right now or ever.
And it was just such a satisfying conclusion for me too. I mean, we've been writing for years about when is Jon Rahm going to finally break into the major comm. I mean, this is a generational talent, a player who, talking to Tim Mickelson, his former college coach at Arizona State, then his former manager, and now the caddy for his brother Phil, he says he thinks that Jon Rahm is capable of winning the Grand Slam. Like, I think he meant the career Grand Slam and not like the Rombo Slam where now he's just going to rip off four majors in a row. Like, I think he meant the career Grand Slam. But I mean, that's the type of talent that we're talking about here. You know, potential to be Europe's best ever player, the potential to be the best player among the Rorys, the Spieths, the JTs, the Brooks, all these guys in that generation. This is the caliber of player that we're looking at. He just ascended to number one in the world for the first time. And so I think it was just satisfying in the sense that we don't need to talk about that anymore. This is a player who already has more than a dozen wins in his career. And so for him to pick one off and to kind of get in line now with a player like Colin Morikawa, who's kind of in that same cut from that same mold. I know you don't think very highly of Colin Morikawa's chances to reach double digit wins as we've revisited on this podcast a number of times. But Jon Rahm, it would not surprise me at all if he can now parlay this into having 15, 16, 17 type wins on the PGA Tour with, what do you think, 4, 5, 6 majors? I don't think that's unrealistic at all.
I don't think so either, simply because you look at how well his game travels. I mean, he has played well at a lot of vastly different venues. Obviously, Torrey Pines is somewhere that favors him, which is great, and that's where he gets his first major. He got his first PGA Tour win. But I think you're absolutely right. The career Grand Slam, that's tough because, I mean, again, I'll revisit what
he has. He has the game for it.
It's difficult, though. I mean, how many times do I have to write this column about Phil Mickelson? I mean, he had the game for it, too, and that ship has sailed. I'm not going to write that column ever again. I promise you, Scout's Honor, I'm not writing that column again. And so I think it's just going to be difficult for John to get that done. It's a very, very high bar.
But I would say this was the highest hurdle to clear to me is the U.S. Open. The Masters, he's already had a couple of chances to win the
Not
Masters.
Not a Torrey Pines. No. I mean, given his history on this golf course, I wouldn't agree with that.
You don't think that winning the U.S. Open is the hardest hill for players who are seeking the career Grand Slam to climb?
I think it varies from player to player. In John's particular case, and it's easy for me to say that now because he has that U.S. Open title, I would say the Open Championship, because bad bounces, being on the wrong side of the draw, the rub of the green, whatever you want to call it, that's sort of part and parcel of the Open Championship. And those are the things. And again, I don't want to circle back around and start digging into all the things we know about John Rahm, but those are the things that are hard for a player of that caliber to swallow. And I can see, and we've seen it impact players of his caliber before, where maybe this isn't my cup of tea. And Rory said it before he ended up winning his. I think in his particular case, you have to get lucky and be very, very good, but you do have to be lucky to win the Open Championship.
Yeah, and look, John Rahm's record in the Open Championship is not good so far, but I'm looking more at his record as a very young player still, has runaway victories at the Irish Open, as well as several other events on the European Tour. So for me, at least, winning a U.S. Open, which is so brutally difficult, was actually the hardest, highest hurdle for him to clear. And I think it could be a little bit of an issue. Go ahead.
Well, I think the one thing that I saw, and you brought it up before, and I didn't even realize this until, again, red eyes, traveling, playing golf on Monday, a lot of things going on. Him moving to number one in the world, that was very, very quietly special, because DJ had a stranglehold on that for quite a while. Even though DJ hasn't been playing very good golf, he had a stranglehold on that for a long time. And when I look down the list, and I know we're going to move to the Olympics talk, but for him to move to number one in the world, for him to establish himself like that, going into the Olympics, going in the Ryder Cup, I think that speaks volumes.
Of course, DJ could take it back. I think all he needs to finish is like inside the top 30 this week at the Travelers Championship, where he is the defending champion. Now, DJ won't be at the Olympics. John Rahm will be the headliner, of course, when the world's best head to Tokyo. Now, who will be, Rex, America's next Olympic star? The U.S. Olympic trials continue this week with track and field and gymnastics across NBCSN, Peacock, and NBC. And don't miss headlining competition with five-time Olympic medalist Simone Biles on both Friday and Sunday on NBC. And now, Rex, just to button up some of our U.S. Open talk, which player do you think is kicking themselves the most for how the final round played out?
You know what? I think a lot of people would probably say Brooks, because he had an opportunity. He shot a final round 69. I think that's probably pretty good considering those conditions. I don't know that I specifically asked Rory, and he wasn't kicking himself. Looked, it was an opportunity, and he had a chance. He felt like he had a very good opportunity, and he didn't get it done. If I probably had to pick anyone, it was Xander. Only because I felt like this was one he felt like he could have. In retrospect, when he looks at the things that we just talked about, as far as 10 players within tied for the lead or within one stroke of the lead, he was one of those players. This is his home course. I think we can all agree, probably now that John has a major, Xander's right there squarely in that, you know, stupid conversation about best player without a major championship. And this was going to be a good opportunity for him. So, yes, I think if anyone's kicking himself, it's Xander.
You want to talk about a move backfiring. Xander Schauffele switched to the arm lock putting method before the Memorial Tournament. 7 of those 8 rounds since, he has lost strokes gained putting to the rest of the field. I am curious to see if that trend continues and that is the method that he ends up going with. I think it, not to cop out here, it has to be a tie between, who you did not mention, and Brooks Koepka. I'll start with Louis first. He was playing what I thought was a fine final round on 17. Where's the one place you cannot miss? It is left. You can blow it 100 yards right on 18. All you have is a grandstand.
Want me to answer,
so you're
that?
Just going
to
get a TOI.
Just going to throw
it out there. It was a rhetorical question. And yeah. What does Louis do, who predominantly hits a left to right ball flight? He misses it left. That is pressure in its purest form, is a guy missing left where you cannot miss with the tournament on the line. And I was also a little bit disappointed that Louis didn't give it a run on 18. I think he only had, 223, something along those lines, in order to cover. I mean, you got to give it a go, man. You're not going to hole out a 100-yard wedge. You're not going to hole out a 100-yard wedge shot. Just try and bust it up somewhere near the green. Try and get it into a bunker and hole it out for an eagle that way. That
no,
to me was
no Bryson. I'm curious. I thought for sure you were going to lean into Bryson, considering that he was right there up until the turn and before he imploded.
I just didn't think that was Bryson's week. I didn't think it was necessarily a golf course that had suited him. He hasn't putted well on Poana in the past. To me, it was a surprise that Bryson was even in that position. And before, I mean, going 33-44 was certainly a head scratcher. But it wasn't like, so getting to my second point, I thought Brooks and the way he closed. And I remember distinctly bringing this up on the US Open preview podcast was, do you think that there is any scar tissue with Brooks Koepka and how he's handled the majors over the past couple of years? And what does he do? He bogeys both 16 and 18, most incredibly, in order to fall all the way back to 2 under par. He had a very good opportunity to not just post 4 under, but to post 5 under, which really would have given the guys a lot to think about with 60 to 90 minutes remaining in the golf tournament.
I would agree with that. And look, we've come to expect a certain level of performance at the major championships out of Brooks Koepka for all the right reasons. Look, when he gets to a major, he has a different gear. We've seen it time and time again. It seemed like we were seeing that last week, and he did fall flat late. He's not the only one. As we just said, there was a lot of guys who sort of ran into roadblocks. I don't know if it was necessarily him getting to a point where his game just doesn't hold up late. I think that's a bit of a stretch because he's done it so many times in the past. I don't know why you would say that. I think it was more of a testament to, it was just a really, really hard golf course coming down the stretch. And you expected guys to shoot 67, 68, 69 to finish up, to put pressure on the lead. It's not easy. I mean, I know sometimes in these podcasts, we want to make it sound like, oh, it's easy. All he had to do was shoot 2 under par. He'd be right there. It was a very, very difficult golf course. The USGA set it up hard on Sunday for a reason. They knew what they were trying to do. And I will give just full props to John Rahm for being able to do what he did on Sunday, as opposed to take something away from a Brooks Koepka, who it seems like he tried and he got very, very aggressive coming down the stretch and he didn't get it done.
So you're not at all concerned.
No,
just like we
no.
talked about in the US Open preview podcast about what Brooks Koepka has done in the majors over the last 3 years on Sunday. 2019 Masters, missed back-to-back 10-footers on 17 and 18, which really could have given Tiger some fits coming down the stretch. He nearly coughed up a 7-shot lead on the back nine at Bethpage. You get to last year in 2020, he had an opportunity. He was just 1 or 2 shots back at the PGA Championship, sort of popping off about how he was the only one with major chops, ended up imploding and dropped out outside the top 25. Go now to Kiawah Island. Just last month at the PGA Championship, he's staring down 50-year-old Phil Mickelson, who hasn't even sniffed major contention over the past 5 years, against big, bad Brooks Koepka, who since 2017 has been by far the best player in the majors. And what does he do? He falls flat yet again. Are you not sensing a trend here with Brooks in the majors over the last 2.5 years?
No, not necessarily. And the reason I say that is because Jack Nicklaus finished runner-up 19 times in major championships. They're hard for a reason. I mean, I know we like to dismiss performances and say, well, he could have gotten it done. Well, of course he could. I mean, there's a reason why major championships are so hard to win. And you talk about what he did against Phil Mickelson. I think Phil simply played better than everyone else.
He didn't play better than him on the front nine. I promise you that.
No, he didn't. But again, this comes down to the stretch. I don't think you're not going to debate with me when it comes to John Rahm that he executed the shots coming down
yes,
the stretch.
John Rahm won the US Open more than Brooks lost. I'm not insinuating that at all.
So yeah, no, I'm not going to sit here and start second guessing, wondering if he's lost some sort of gear. Not until, if you ask me that 3 years from now, and we've got another 4 or 5 examples of him coming into Sunday, having an opportunity, maybe, but no, man. I mean,
the sample size is growing. The sample size of close calls not converted.
Well, the sample
in the
size includes one that he won, by the way. So you're kind of skewing the facts on this one. You're using one of his victories.
He almost lost it.
Almost, but he actually didn't. So he won. You can sit here and skew it all you want. He actually won one of the examples that you gave me. You just said John Rahm won. So of those 4 examples you've given me, you take 2 of them out. So yes, I don't think this is a trend at all. He's putting himself into contention on Sundays. And that's really what any player can ask. And I'm not here, I am not into defending Brooks. Let's be honest. What's transpired over the last month is not cool. If we're going to sit here and do Team Brooks and Team Bryson, I'm Team Bryson because I'm actually
Team Bryson too.
You know who else is Team Bryson? Was my son. He was a big fan of Bryson after watching him all week long.
That's good to know. I think Bryson, quite honestly, even though there's reports of him throwing out fans at the memorial, I think Bryson treats his fans a whole lot better than Brooks does, who just seems too cool for not just school, but basically everything in life.
One of those guys is on the Olympic team too.
That is Bryson.
And I had an opportunity to talk with an agent who was in the room. And this is interesting to me. And I'm making a very, very quick transition to the Olympics, that all four of the Americans who are currently qualified for the Olympics, it seems like all four are going to play. It's Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, Xander Schauffele, and Bryson DeChambeau. And I think there were some questions. Xander talked about it when he left Torrey Pines. He said he had a decision to make. He's going to play, which I think is really, really cool, because I could imagine a situation where these players didn't want to make that trip. And Xander talked about it. I thought he did a very good job of sort of laying out that you go to the Olympics to win a medal, but you also go for the experience. And we all know that it won't be the same experience that we all expected it to be because of COVID-19. And for all four of those guys to commit, I think it's cool.
We have seen a spate of WDs over the past couple of days. Sergio Garcia, Terrell Hatton, Rafa Cabrera-Bello WD'd on Wednesday. Lee Westwood said he's not going to show up. I don't believe
Dustin Johnson.
Yeah, that was months ago. Adam Scott. I mean, there's Louis Oosthuizen said he's not going to go. So look, there's been a number of players who aren't going to go. My theory, and I've said this basically since 2016, I would rather just have people who want to be there. I don't want to feel like they have to go because of their sponsors. I don't want to feel like they have to go because they feel some kind of nationalistic pride. I want players who want to be there, who don't mind forfeiting a week's worth of money to play for something bigger than themselves. And so I'm looking forward to seeing it. I know you are looking forward to going over there for 16 or 17 days where you'll not just be quarantined in your hotel, but you actually get to cover both the men's and women's championships.
It's my understanding the quarantine is the whole 14 days I'm there. I don't get out of quarantine until after the final round of the women's competition, which is kind of cool. So I'll have one day in Tokyo that I'm not on quarantine and I can go enjoy myself.
How much sushi do you think you'll eat?
I don't know. My understanding is I'm going to have to eat in my hotel room every night. So I don't know about door dashing sushi, even in Tokyo. I don't feel comfortable with that.
That's basically the same thing that you do in La Jolla or the Hamptons, eating in your hotel room during what is essentially a major championship. That's no different.
No, not necessarily. We ate out plenty last week. Don't make it sound like did. I'm eating in my hotel.
California opened up and it was glorious. Rex, it is absolutely pouring out. And so I'm not sure I'll be able to fire up the grill as I was hoping in my new crib. What do you have on the docket here for the next couple of days before more IPAs at lacrosse games?
I have two more days of lacrosse games, and then I'm going to go home and finally get a chance to mow my lawn, which hasn't been mowed in 2 weeks. What do you think that looks like?
That's going to be an absolute jungle. I moved into my new neighborhood a week or two ago, and I already got scolded this morning by a neighbor. I thought it was going to be because my lawn was so long, because the previous owner, as is his prerogative, did not cut the lawn for the previous few weeks. I work to hire a lawn service to get that cut. So the front yard was basically about a foot deep. And so I thought the guy was going to scold me about that. But instead, he wasn't scolding me about how long it was. He was scolding me because the lawn service company apparently blew the clippings into the road. And he came over. I was taking my kid to daycare, came over me, had me roll down my window. And he said, them blowing their lawn clippings into the road is, quote, unacceptable for this neighborhood. So I should have told him any number of choice words. Instead, take it up with the lawn service company, because that is what I'm paying them for, is to dispose of those lawn clippings. And if he doesn't like it, well, take it up with them. That does not sound like a me problem. It sounds like a you problem.
You're going to fit in perfectly in Nakatee. Yep. I can see it
already.
Right now.
Already making plenty of friends in Ponte Vedra. All right.
Why don't you do your own lawn? No, I really want to know. Why wouldn't you just do your own lawn?
They were here for an hour today. And okay. they got all their fancy equipment. It was 85 degrees. It's humid. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that at all. And I actually have somewhat of a yard. It's the second biggest yard in the neighborhood. Not to brag.
Sounds like a brag.
From someone who just had like a sliver of lawn where we used to build and lived in Orlando. This is certainly.
Well, we haven't done this in 3 weeks. So I'm going to go ahead and set you up. What's Lab got on the grill this weekend?
So I'm really hoping the storm passes and so I can fire up the Traeger. So last night I smoked some salmon on the Big Green Egg. Our great friend Ron Greed Jr., who writes for Global Golf Post, he just got a Big Green Egg for Father's Day. And so I did a video for him, basically showing him step by step on how to do that. So that
you
was
did
last
a video
night.
Of you, like yes. of you, yeah, narrating, really.
Yes, showing him exactly how you would do it from start to finish, from the light up process to actually cooking the meat, to closing down the dampers and preserving the lump charcoal. Yeah, it was very thorough. And so if ever your wife takes off your shackles and allows you to be a man and get a man sized grill. Then I can just forward you what I did last night. But to answer your question, we're doing some teriyaki chicken on the Traeger tonight, which is Wednesday night. Tomorrow we're having our Father's Day celebration, which will consist of some steak and mashed potatoes. It's gonna be a big weekend, Rex. And then of course we're hitting the water parks over the weekend. I'm hoping to smoke some ribs on the Gateway, but you have to stay tuned early next week to see if that actually happens or if I just got too sunburned and wanted to drink Gatorade to refuel.
That sounds like the latter. Sounds like you're not making it through the weekend and doing all that. It seems to me that it's wildly ambitious considering that you just got home. You still look a little tired. Looks like
I'm exhausted.
Wandering around.
There's a lot. I mean, I just built a bookshelf, which, you know, had a screw missing. I didn't carve the wood by hand, but there's a lot of other projects that need to get done. I need to build a couple of tables. I showed you the office that needs to be framed out. So there is a lot going on, but I am hopeful that when we come to you next on this podcast, that I do have an updated menu that I was able to do in the Ponte Vedra house. That's enough about me. I want to hear more about you. Leave us a comment, especially on Rex's Twitter page, what you think of this podcast, and don't forget you can always ratio him with whatever your thoughts are. All right, we'll see you next time on the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf.